Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Augustin Macellari.
On today's show, we'll be meeting Armenian writer Vikan Barbarian to learn more about his architectural social satire comic, The Structure is Rotten, Comrade.
Then we'll be discussing ramshackle bothies, bolt holes and bivouacs with the author Dan Richards.
And with the Biennale looming, we'll be hearing more about a permanent new art district launching in Venice.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Bill Lutie will be looking ahead to next week's news, and we're enjoying some music too right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Aug, lovely to see you here in Studio One. Bright and breezy, a temperate Studio One. What do you wear in the studio when it's freezing, though? You know how our editor-in-chief likes to come in and make it 9 degrees centigrade maximum?
Yeah, it's good
what
for radio.
What do you wear when the boss has got the air con turned down?
See your breath frosting in front of you. Do you know what I wear? The same as normal, I just suffer.
Just the Speedos?
Just the Speedos.
Okay, well, I'm glad we've painted a nice picture for our Sunday listening several. We've got a cracking show lined up. Shall we headlong into it?
Let's welcome
the beautiful Bill Lutie into the studio.
Which way are you going, Billy? Can I go too?
I like your theme tune, Bill. Where have you been this week? Do you deserve that theme tune?
Well, it's about where I'm going. I'm going to the news.
Okay.
Of next week. Where have I been this week? Here.
Okay.
Working like the rest of us. Oh, yeah, the news. I remember. Well, this week we've talked about it so much on Monocle 24. We'll continue to talk about it. Emperor Akihito is abdicating in Japan. He's the first emperor to do so in a long time. The world is kind of losing it about it. I'm not quite sure why it's so huge.
Well, what if the Queen abdicated in the UK?
I mean, it'd be a big deal, wouldn't it?
It would be a humongo deal. Right. Mm. And he had to seek special dispensation from Japanese Parliament to do so.
So he had to ask to do it, and then they were like, and then they thought there was going to be a millennium bug style calendar thing.
Right. His departure ushers in a new era for Japan.
Should we move on?
Let's.
It's the Billboard Music Awards on Wednesday.
Right. Who's going to be winning that?
Well, lots of people. Okay. I didn't realise there are so many. I think I counted more than 50. There are about 56 different categories.
Ooh, that's a long award ceremony.
It's a long one, isn't it?
Oh, you got some party biscuits for that one.
You're going to need something, or you're going to need maybe a couple of trips to the
trips.
I don't know, to the loo. I don't know. Bring an iPad with some films on Netflix downloaded or something.
Bring a good book.
Yeah.
What we recommend at this.
That's the sensible one. Some of the performers, there's some heavy hitters here. BTS.
Okay,
only
the
biggest
Korean
band
people,
in the world. Kelly Clarkson, she's hosting and also singing. That's pretty good of her.
Yeah.
The Jonas Brothers, Khalid, Madonna's going to be there. Don't tell Fernando. Paula Abdul. Do you know much about Paula Abdul?
Yeah, she's kind of my era.
Yeah, I think I'm a little bit young for her, but she's coming back. She's doing some of her best hits. Anyway, Cardi B, 21 nominations. She's up there.
Wow.
She's the most nominated. In three categories, she's literally competing against herself.
How much capital do they have, really? Does anyone care?
No, I don't think so, really.
Okay.
I don't know. I've never really... I mean, I've heard of them, but I've never paid attention to them.
Well,
don't
best of
say
luck to
this
Cardi.
Is your second one of your news stories that you're not personally interested in.
You wait till you hear story number three.
Come on, let's hear it.
Yeah.
It's Mild May.
Oh, here we go. Okay.
We were talking
now
about
I do
this
know what this
ago.
Is because I am a subscriber to the London Drinker.
Ah, so for those of you who don't know what Mild May is, which is presumably literally everyone that isn't in this room, it's the Campaign for Real Ale, so a UK kind of real ale beer lobby group, or maybe support group. I don't know what
support group.
And they're pushing this very specific type of ale called mild, which is flat, warm. Dark. It doesn't taste of much. It's 3% alcohol, so it doesn't even get you drunk.
Okay.
I bloody love it. Do you not?
I love it too.
Yeah,
it's
nice.
Kind of up my
good
street.
Session beer.
For some reason, the production of it has declined. Camera throughout May are urging people to go out and buy a pint of mild. I would have brought some in, but it's a little bit early.
Bill, thank you for a wonderful news look ahead.
Thank you.
Have a lovely rest of your weekend.
I will, and I'll see you later for a mild.
You Yerevan-based writer and essayist Vikan Barbarian is no stranger to satire. An early novel explored the malevolent interior life of a would-be suicide bomber through the lens of his fascination with food. But now Barbarian has turned his considerable talents to graphic novels.
In his new book, The Structure is Rotten, Comrade, Barbarian explores how the myth of progress can be used to obfuscate the horrid truth of oligarchies. Replete with appropriately chaotic illustrations by Jan Kebby, Barbarian turns his caustic gaze on an optimistic, if misguided, young architect called Frunz, whose obsession with concrete is causing problems for the citizens of Yerevan.
As Armenia marks the first anniversary of the Velvet Revolution, Vikan spoke to Augustine about the strange way that life can end up imitating art. He began, however, by talking Aug through the book.
At the centre of the book, the hero is this hapless architect. His name is Frunz, who happens to be half French, half Armenian. He drops out of architecture school in Paris, joins his father, who is a builder in one of the former Soviet republics, Armenia, which is now independent. It's been independent since the early 1990s. And the country and its capital, Yerevan, is in the midst of a reconstruction boom. So he joins his father's construction firm. His dad is also an architect and builder, to essentially ravage all the historic monuments, all the historic buildings of the city, and recreate it in kind of a hodgepodge, postmodern, really a city in poor taste. And I don't want to give the entire story away, but at some point in the story, there is a lot of angst, collective angst in the country, in the capital itself, and there's civil unrest, and there is a popular uprising, and son and father are caught in the middle of this uprising, and the father, Sergei, Frunz's dad, Sergei, works very closely with the old regime, the Ancien Regime, which is a group, well, which consists of the oligarchs, essentially, the oligarchs who run the country. So, essentially, a war erupts between the rebels, the revolutionaries, the disenfranchised, and the ruling elites. And so Frunz, the son, is caught in this uprising, and I won't tell you how it ends, but essentially that's a bare skeletal sort of sketch of the plot. It didn't start off as a political story, but like most everything, it veered toward the political. Jan, who's Houdini Hans, drew the book, is more likely to say that this is an aesthetic work. And for me, it's also first and foremost a desire to create a work of art that exists above the political for me and really goes across genres. But that's how it kind of, I would say, it started.
You mentioned the architect and his kind of collaborative relationship with the corrupt oligarchy who are demolishing Yerevan to make way for this tasteless postmodernist concrete jungle. One of the set pieces that really struck me in the book is when the architect is confronted by some of the protesters. And throughout, there's been this recurring motif of protesters carrying stools, carrying these Alvar Aalto stools. And they say, you know, our homes are being demolished. We've been promised flats, but all we've been given is this stool. And there's a real absurdity to it. I found it quite funny. But I wondered about what your reflections are on the politics of design and the politics of architecture and, you know, the kind of, I suppose, bourgeois need that these stalls meet versus the actual need of the people who've lost their homes.
Yeah, well, that stool it brings out an absurd moment, and it reappears, as you say, in the book. It's a constant, more or less. And I think we use it in different ways, but one of them is the Alvar Aalto stool as a problem-solving prop, just like the plunger, the bathroom plunger is used by Nancy, the precocious comic character Nancy. I don't know if you know her in Ernie Bushmiller's comic strips. The plunger is used as a problem-solving tool. And so we were using that in a subversive way, not so much as a problem-solving tool, but this stool, iconic piece of furniture, as an object of discontent, as a weapon almost, by the disenfranchised, the homeless, the people who were being essentially kicked out. And this actually happened, it transpired in Yerevan. Thousands of people were kicked out of their homes so that the developers could essentially put up high-rises. And so they were given a petty amount of money to leave their homes. And large sections of the city actually have undergone this kind of development without really the consent of the residents. They just had to leave, essentially, and take the money. And some of the cases actually have ended up in the European courts. But just to come back to the other Alto stool, so we use it in this absurd way where Frunz, the hero, and his father, the developer, the builder, actually gives the stool as a form of compensation to the residents who are being kicked out of their homes. So instead of getting a small amount of money for losing their homes, in our graphic novel, they end up getting these stools. So the stools are ubiquitous in the novel. You see the people being kicked out sort of sitting on their stools or sitting crouched on the stools, playing chess, which is a national pastime in Armenia, on their stools. The stools being used as a weapon against the oligarchs, you know, whose regime is, I won't say how it ends, but is challenged in the book. But this was sort of in a larger context. You asked about design. I think the fate of architecture and design, I think, must have been very closely linked in Europe during the interwar period between World War I and World War II. And your question made me think of, for example, the Bauhaus movement and its founder, Gropius, who actually had to flee Nazi Germany in the 1930s. And first he went to the United Kingdom, and then he moved to the United States and became the head of the Harvard School of Design. And the Bauhaus movement essentially migrated with him from Europe to the United States. And he was not the only one. He had many peers, Mies van der Rohe, Behrens, many others. And so in a way, the architecture was exported, or the Bauhaus movement, the principles of the Bauhaus movement were migrated from Europe to the United States. And even in Israel, there were many architects and designers in Germany who fled Germany and settled in Tel Aviv. And now Tel Aviv actually has the highest concentration of Bauhaus structures and Bauhaus buildings. It's a city called the White City. I don't know if you're familiar, in the world. So in a way, I think these two things, architecture and politics, are very much linked. And who knows what the United States, who knows what Chicago would have looked like if Gropius and his colleagues had not left, you know, had not changed countries. And they may have looked like completely different cities than they do today. So these two things, I think, are design and politics, are very much linked. And this was definitely something I was thinking about.
In the book, you know, Franz's wide-eyed love for, well, his dad is the person that he kind of idolizes, but the only things he seems to love more are concrete and Le Corbusier. There's a sort of arrogance that he channels, especially at the beginning of the book. He walks around and he kind of looks around the city and he says, you know, we're getting rid of all this old crap and we're going to throw up modern, powerful, new edifices. Obviously, modernism is kind of still very integral to a lot of people's perspectives on design. You know, it's definitely having a kind of extended moment. And you don't hear too much criticism of it. The criticism comes more laterally around, you know, for example, in London, what happened in high-rise developments, as opposed to the kind of optimistic vision that spurred their building in the first place. In this, you're kind of, I feel like you're sort of slightly ripping on modernism when you kind of imbue Franz with this like slightly anachronistic arrogance, that arrogance of the kind of male 20th century master architect.
Yes, but I'm not convinced actually that Franz has really mastered the principles of modernist architecture the way that, you know, the true masters, like Gropius, for example, had. And sort of his understanding, I think, of modernist architecture is somewhat of a caricature. He sort of borrows axioms and principles of modernism from different designers and architects and really misapplies them, which sort of raises the question, you know, what is this Franz really about? What is his father and his dad's architectural construction firm really about? It's called RAD, the Radical Architecture Department. And what it really is about is making money. It's really about building residential high-rises to sell just based on speculation to rent out. So these aren't people that who are really concerned, as they claim to be, by the principles of form and function. In fact, there's a part in the book where there's reference to that famous architectural axiom that people attribute wrongly to Mies van der Rohe, because Mies van der Rohe actually took that from Peter Behrens. Less is more, and that's taken, and at some point in the book, less is more turns into more is more, and, you know, more high-rises, more money, more cement. Yeah, I don't really think Franz is really inspired by the great works of architecture.
It's very difficult to talk about this book, which, as you said, contains this kind of violent uprising, when we're so close to the first year anniversary of the Velvet Revolution in Armenia. What did the atmosphere feel like to you? Was there a sense, did you have this, because obviously you'd completed the manuscript by that point, did you have this sense of, uh-oh, like, is this life imitating art here?
I did. I did. But the uprising in the book, as you said, is truly much more violent than what happened actually here in Armenia. And it was somewhat surreal. There were more than 100,000 people engaged in protests. In the context of a country with less than, you know, 3 million people, that's quite significant, more than 100,000 protesters. But it was unruly at times. No one knew if it would turn violent or not. And the so-called forces of order were very much present in the streets with their weapons and sundries and barbed wire. But fortunately, it did not go that way. And it's true that if you look outside of Armenia, you see, you know, plenty of signs of collective angst spilling over into national protest movements. And at times, those events do turn violent because people do feel like they've been left behind, that their purchasing power has been diminished, that they're paying more taxes than ever compared to multinationals in percentage terms. You know, a multinational pays less taxes in percentage terms than a teacher does. So you've seen this also, what you said, when we saw it manifested in Armenia in the form of the Velvet Revolution, it was somewhat surreal because the manuscript, as you said, was completed. But then we saw it again, the same type of movement, and we're seeing it now in places like France with the yellow vests. And so this is not something specific to this region or to Armenia.
Vikan Barbarian there, and his new graphic novel, The Structure is Rotten, Comrade, is out in May on Fantagraphics Books. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Time for some new music. With Bothies, the traditional refuge of the hiker, the subject of our next chat, what better, Rob, to get us in the mood than the Fat White Family's brand new Ode to the Tootsie, Feet.
my eyes. The thing that I saw down there, down between your thighs, I consume it over and over again. Roll over at the lock, holy bullet skin. If I turn it over, would you make it work? When you plug it in, will you dig the dirt? Can you count me sideways to that other realm? Can you take me up there? Can you take the helm? Beat me for the promise. I pray and I pray God. My refugee is throbbing underneath the sod. Deep inside a man, a loyal to his arms. Deep inside a stranger, necessity of song. We'll be right back.
That was Feet by the brilliant Fat White Family. You are tuned in to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Author Dan Richards' work has focused on topics ranging from the eccentricities of the British landscape in his 2013 book Holloway, which he co-authored with Robert McFarlane and the Radiohead cover designer Stanley Donwood, to following in the footsteps of his great-great-aunt and uncle up mountains in the more recent volume Climbing Days.
His latest book is Outpost, looking at the makeshift, unusual and isolated buildings that we find amid the wilderness. Bothies, bivouacs, shacks or shelters in locations ranging from the Utah desert to the Arctic Circle.
Monocle's Tom Hall recently spoke to Dan Richards about the book, and we joined the conversation with him discussing how his interest in the outdoors was first passed on to him as a boy by his father.
Everything's normal when you're growing up, because every family has a secret, as Alan Bennett said, and the secret is they're not like other families. And a few days before I was born, my dad came back from an expedition. He'd been up near Nyålsund on Svalbard, which is Norwegian archipelago, the last land before the North Pole. And when he came back, he'd been away for a few months, so he was surprised that my mother was so pregnant, because I was the first child and he hadn't really got his head around that, you know, he'd come back and everything would be different. And he brought the polar bear pelvis, this bony frame, very, very beautiful alien artifact, which he'd discovered on, I think, around the Kongsfjord glacier. And that lived in our various houses when I was a kid and was always the subject of acute and really passionate fascination for me as an object. It was so interesting, and it was very, very old, I think, when my father found it. So it was properly bleached and just interesting to behold to a child, and to look at the broken ends of the hip ends was to see something that was quite coral-like. And then you had these almost line of dorsal numps and bumps and fins down the back, and it was an amazing thing. And so it was always in the house, and to look at it and to hold it and to pick it up and observe it was to imagine my father out there in this, you know, in the Arctic, and imagine polar bears, and to feel my horizons expand just by the means of this oracular object. And so during that trip, the other artifact from a trip was a photograph of him staying with his team in what, on the face of it, was an incredibly ordinary-looking garden shed that, you know, is probably the furthest north shed on Earth. And in my head, you know, it's the shed at the top of the world.
And that shed, as you explain in the book, and I've seen the photo, it sleeps a fairly alarming amount of people for the size that it looks.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's a really weird shed at a number of points, but the main weird thing about it is it's there at all. And yes, it apparently slept six, which I find boggling. I mean, maybe six if they all stood up and slept standing up. And on one side of the picture is the sort of elephant gun that my dad had. And, you know, that was the preventative measure in case of curious or very hungry polar bears. And this shed doesn't look like it could stand up to a light breeze, let alone a sort of like excitable polar bear. And so that was really probably the first encounter with the idea of this outpost idea.
And you make sort of light of it about the fact that a lot of these structures are shed-like, travelling sheds, sheds in the wrong place kind of thing. But I mean, really, if we were trying to give listeners a sort of mind's eye vision of the kinds of structures that we're broadly talking about, I mean, yeah, if you dump a garden shed on top of a mountain or in a woodland, that's really the kinds of places you're seeking out in this book, aren't you? Like these small, barely protected, but just protected enough structures in nature.
Enough architecture for there to be a noticeable difference from being outside. One of the places I visited was a sail house in Iceland called Hvatnes. And sail house roughly translates as house of joy, because the Norse would build these very, very, really they were making across the inland hinterland of Iceland to make journeys possible. They would build a kind of join the dots of these man-made caves, in a way, if you will, a kind of like stone and turf igloo. And then several Norse would get in, and it was a place where you could sleep in relative warmth when there was nothing else around for miles and miles. You could store some provisions and things like that. And now, over the years, like Trigger's broom, they have been rebuilt and rebuilt and refurbished. And now many of them, like the cabins I encountered in the Alps, are quite modern structures, or at least passable bunkhouses. You know, you can look at it and think, okay, this is a house of some sort. But other places that I visited are fundamentally made with a particular purpose in mind. So I went to see Desolation Peak's fire lookout where Jack Kerouac was in the mid-50s for 63 days, which looks like a little station waiting room. It's the very image of a fire watch cabin. It's not up on a tower, it's just sitting on the top of Desolation Peak, and it affords 360-degree views of the Cascade Range. And there Kerouac sat, thoroughly crazed for most of the time and not really enjoying his singular existence, searching out possible smoke on the horizon that he could see. He had a fire finder, all of this. I also visit Cordon, which is a lighthouse off the coast of France, quite near Bordeaux, which is the most remarkable lighthouse. The base is this amazing sandstone Palladian gem, and halfway up you have an apartment for the King of France, which shows you kind of how old that was, because they haven't had one for a while. Above that, you have a chapel dedicated to the Virgin Mary with this amazing coffered dome that is reminiscent of the Pantheon in Rome. And then above that, in mid-1700s, they added an extra 20 metres to it. And there you have the most beautifully engineered, spiralling up tower. And at the top, you have the light room there, which was where Fresnel Sea Road tested all of his amazing lenses that then became standard in all the major rock lighthouses pretty much in Europe, if not the world, latterly. So there you have somewhere that was so important and it was there to be seen. And a lot of the places I went, they're entirely unknown. So I'd really tried, when I was thinking about the roll call of places to visit in the book, to include things that had different characteristics, but also things that had fundamentally different purposes. There are cabins here that are for people to discover, and there are cabins or beacons or outposts that were there for a really important and almost universal purpose.
And you also went to Mars?
Yes.
Obviously not the planet. Tell people a little bit about that journey.
As close to Mars as really you can get on Earth. I went down to Utah, a Utah desert near a place called Hanksville, which, as everyone in the area kept telling me, is not really a place, but a very small settlement on the edge of a Utah desert. And there is a working analogue of how they think a Mars base might look. And I spoke to Dr. Shannon Rupert and the team from the Mars Society there. And they are engaged in scientific research, but a lot of it is also sociological. How do people put up with isolation, sensory deprivation? Can people remain in SIM, as they call it, at the HAB? They have the Mars base. Can the people who go there remain in this imaginative state where you have to stand in an airlock for 10 minutes before you can go out to let things pressurise and depressurise? You're wearing your suit the whole time and it has air filtering through, but you're not carrying oxygen. But as best they can, they are trying to simulate what things would be like. And this is, the presumption is that if and when people go to Mars, it will take 6 to 8 months to get there. Then you'll be there for a period of time, depending on the, I think, the orbits of the Earth and Mars. You'll either be there for a month. If something's gone terribly wrong, then you come home, and that's another 6 to 8 months to get home, or you're there for about 18 months. And so the sort of people who'll go, how they deal with the pressure, whether they can deal with the kind of white noise of total panic at the back of their heads at all times, to know that you're going away from the Earth for half a year with no real possibility of getting back if anything goes wrong, and then you're as far away as you'll ever be, and then coming back. And it was so interesting to visit this simulation in the Mars desert, and it was really uncanny and really genuinely odd. And I hitched, or tried to hitch, my way down there. And I say in the book that I really felt like sort of Hugh Grant stumbled onto the set of No Country for Old Men. I was completely out of my depth, but that's good in a way. I think trying to get round the boondocks of America and not being able to drive, because I can't, you end up talking to people, you end up being told crazy stories.
You really do. I've made the multiple mistake of having gone to LA at least 3 times without having a driving license, and people just look like you're actually insane when you say you're going to get
on
a bus.
It's not for you. No. It's not for you, the pedestrian. In the same way, I caught a flight from Seattle down to LA, and I ended up discovering I was sitting next to one of the major lawyers for Amazon. And she was talking to me about HQ2 that they are building. And she said that, you know, one of the reasons that they're doing this is because they've drawn some circles on a map and they've discovered where North Korea's projected long-range missiles can reach.
I read that in the book, and it really made me sit up and think.
I mean, the amount of bonkers things going on with Amazon at the moment,
the fact that Amazon is basically looking to relocate is because they're trying to avoid Kim Jong-un's missiles.
I think that's one of the reasons. In the same way that I think Boeing have relocated at least half of their manufacturing force to the south because of different labour laws and things. And I'm sure that that has something to do with Amazon as well. But at the same time, she genuinely gave me the information. That's why we're doing it. And also, if anything bad were to happen, people would need new stuff. You know, they'd need to rebuild because everything would be irradiated. And Amazon is here for you. You know, we are a public service in that way. And to receive that information on a, you know, internal flight above Portland, as I probably was then, just looking out the window, looking at the slightly now apocalyptic sunset, thinking, blimey, America, you funny old place.
I was intrigued when I read the book. It's very human. It's very funny. It's not too overly scholarly, but it does touch on lots of other writers' work, which you have to be fairly writerly to even have a baseline knowledge of to write a book in this way. I wondered, how much reading did you do in intentional relation to the subject, and how much of this is just because you are clearly an avid reader and you have read a lot of books in your lifetime up to this? Where were you grabbing those quotes from? Was it, I have to find them, or did you know them? I mean, we're talking about the work of like Philip Larkin, Kerouac, Thoreau, even Dylan Thomas and people like that.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of people like Rebecca Solnit and Maggie Nelson and Gretel Ehrlich is in here. And really, the reading happened because I'm quite a tangential person. I like making the connections. A lot of the way that the outposts in the book are connected are by my going. You know, it's a meandering tale, but we get there in the end, and it's the people you meet along the way. And as much as the people I met, I kept meeting these books which spoke to me about what I was doing. And as a result, I was reading a lot as I went. Also, if you're travelling a lot, that's such a joy for me because I get to read. And if you're in a strange place, then books are comfort as well. And I was in some exceptionally strange places quite a lot. When I was up in Svalbard at the end of the book, I actually took along Bob Dylan's Chronicles. And I was reading that, and I suddenly had a double take moment where I thought, I'm reading about Bob Dylan's early life in New York, where it's very cold out and the Hudson is fundamentally frigid and everything's going on. He's up against it. And I'm in a cabin which we just had to remove barbed wire and bear protection measures because apparently in the area, you know, quite reasonably close and reasonably regularly, there are polar bears. And equally, when I was in the Cascade Mountains or when I was in Mars, I think I was reading things not necessarily associated, but things that really sparked these ideas in my head. I'm trying to think of an example. I mean, I've done a select biography in the back, which is quite thorough, but it doesn't include everything, although it does include things like Duck Death and the Tulip and things like that, and sort of Moomin books, as well as PhDs on the poltergeist activity in Sale House in the Icelandic hinterland. So it's a broad, broad thing that I was doing in terms of getting my information and my inspiration. But really, it was just making those connections. And yeah, as you say, I read a lot. It's a wonder just to be able to do that, to spend time in someone else's company. Almost every place in the book, it had this kind of frisson of real excitement because they're outliers, you know, they're unusual. They are off the beaten path by virtue of the fact that, you know, they exist at all. If they were in the main, you know, one of the definitions of outpost that I really like is a party of, I think, soldiers or a camp away from the main army. And I think that's what a lot of these places in the book are. They're places off the beaten track where people can be alone and sort of do what they want to do. It didn't always work out for them, like with Kerouac, who actually discovered that being in his fire lookout, he wasn't the guy he needed to be there. And there's a whole section in the book about how he actually remade his experience time and time again, because a year to the day after he came down from his fire cabin, On the Road was published and his life changed overnight.
And there's also a kind of duality in the experience of it, though, and you kind of highlight it where these places, they were built, most of them, the very remote ones, they were built as places of refuge and almost last resort. But today they're sort of almost also acting as beacons because we can get to places easier. We have more accessibility generally, and the tourist trail gets ever more highly populated. And a lot of these places are, rather than acting as last resort escapes, for example, in Iceland, you talk about how they're kind of almost drawing too many people to these unspoilt wildernesses. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I don't think you can have a wilderness superhighway. And I think often there are places in the world that almost advertise themselves as that. When I was over in Iceland, the Brandt Guide had just announced that this particular trail to the Valley of Thor was one of the top 10 in the world. And the people I was speaking to at the Icelandic Tourism and the Icelandic equivalent of National Trust were bracing themselves now for an influx of Americans, basically. Americans and European people coming over to see because they've got a list. Suddenly this has been added to the go-see bucket list. It's an interesting thing, but I think the counter to that is that when people go to these places which are perhaps not so wild in nature as they were and not so off the beaten track as they were, fundamentally they're still going to a wild place. It may not be wilderness, but it's fundamentally wild. One of the great things about Iceland is the fact it's so changeable in terms of weather. I speak about this in the book. You get people going to these places and there are maybe too many of them there, but suddenly the weather turns around and they are assailed by these great lightning storms in the middle of summer. The wind blows up, everything floods. You really feel that you're in this really savage crucible. And that's good for people, I think, because just because, as you say, just because you can get there, it does not follow the place you go will behave itself. It has not been tamed. And whilst their arguments rage about whether there is really any wilderness left on Earth, in the true sense, have we been everywhere? Have we, in the words of D.H. Lawrence, beshitten everything? is, you know, with our plastic, with our presence, with our the marks that we have left, visible and invisible? Or are perhaps there still places where we are out of our depth, we don't know what we're doing, and we are surprised because we have no control? And I think in search of those sort of places, these outposts are important as a kind of starting point.
It's quite an interesting thing you highlighted there about the fact that, yes, obviously these places with more people coming to them are changing and definitely changing in our perception, but they will always have the power to change the people coming. You know, to be scared, to be made to feel a bit small by nature is always going to change the way you feel about the world.
And I think people need more of that at the moment, because certainly in the age of the Anthropocene, one of those two, the presumed preeminence of the human beings on Earth needs to be challenged, and we need to be woken up and shaken up. And the fact that we think that we are in control day on day, it's becoming clear that that is beyond hubristic.
Also, beshitten, great word.
Thank you. D.H. Lawrence,
Dan Richards there speaking to Tom Hall, and his new book Outpost is available now. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. Finally today, we turn to Venice, where things are surely hotting up as the Biennale approaches. Amongst the arty extravaganza, the magnificent people safari, the orgy of relational aesthetics, serious cultural things are happening, not least the launch of the new permanent Giudecca Arts District.
Opening with installations by the likes of Yoko Ono and Kendall Gears, The Showstopper is bound to be a new film, Body as Home, by the London-based October Collective. Pivotal to the group is artist, musician and all-round creative Faye-Anne Smith, who joins us now.
Hi.
Welcome to the Monocle Weekly. It's lovely to have you here. Faye-Anne, maybe you could just tell us a bit about how the October Collective came to get involved with the Giudecca Art District.
Originally, Alexandra was asked to exhibit in Giudecca, and it was a relatively informal, small kind of deal. And we went over for a logistics recce, and I'm involved in the soundtrack, so we all went together because we're all interested in how this will play out. And we realised that what was happening in Giudecca was amazing. We were filled in by the CEO, Pier Paolo, and he told us that they were planning to inaugurate this permanent art district. And we felt like we really wanted to get involved with launching this new venture, because it was just, I mean, the spaces are amazing. Obviously, operating in London, used to certain kind of small, you know, just grand spaces. It was fantastic. And we built a relationship and we became the flagship project. And it's a really great opportunity, because it's the first time that they're doing this, and it's going to be all year round, as opposed to just every 2 years with the Biennale.
I hope you've managed to, you've kind of maxed out the amount of things that you can take across on a boat or on a canal. That's the kind of thing, right? It's like you've got to have an extensive rider of heavy items, knowing that some poor guy's got to kind of like ferry it across. Is that what you've done? Is there anything in your installation? I mean, I know it's a video work, but have you managed to sort of max out your ferry capacity?
It's a logistical nightmare.
Exactly, right?
I was sort of on the tip of my tongue, because it's true. It's just lots and lots of kit, and we're doing it. Obviously, it's different countries, so it's communication. So yes, we've maxed out everything in every direction. You know, from getting, we're doing it in screens, you see, three screens. So just to make it difficult for ourselves. So all these things have to be delivered. Of course, you've got the situation with everything coming by water. So yeah, it's a challenge, definitely. And we've hopefully risen to it.
And what's Venice like? I mean, we know the Giardini with the permanent pavilions for the Biennale and the Arsenale, where they have the sort of the rest of the stuff during the Biennale week. Is it generally a good place to show art in the kind of the places that aren't designed for it? Is there kind of like some of the kind of nooks and crannies of a city like that actually kind of bring out the creativity in a collective such as yours?
Absolutely. It's so magical. I mean, I went there for the first time for our technical inspection. I just completely fell in love with it. Yeah. It's so rich with symbolism, art, beauty. There isn't a dull place to lay your eyes on, you know? And that is very inspiring to us, definitely. And in terms of uniting with the space that you're in conceptually, there's so much room for that. It has a lot of mystery to it. As an artist, it's incredibly intriguing. And you can do a lot with the spaces that already exist.
When you were putting together this film, you know, it's so rich with history that it maybe could be quite hard not to be almost a bit constrained by it. How did you look at the space and how did you think about your work in relation to it? Did you want to do something that was kind of site-specific and focused on Venice, or did you want it to be a more expansive introduction to the new art district?
I think the theme of the body is quite universal, so it sort of transcends the place that we are. And there's something sensual and quite transcendent about Venice, and these are things that are incorporated into the film. So I feel that in a general sense, it's allied. You know, there's a certain sense of mystery and auspicious occasion in the film and in Venice. So, yeah, I feel they're not closely tied, but the sensibilities are similar. It's not an incongruous place to show it.
And you told us there's three large screens. Thanks to the ferryman, they're going to be installed. How does the thing work? Is it going to be sort of rolling on a loop, kind of 24/7 for the duration of the whole Biennale, which I guess runs until October, November? How can people go and actually see it and enjoy it?
If you come to Giudecca Island, which is just a short...
So I'm taking a left, ride. Okay.
It's easy to get to. Yeah. You'll be taxing me somewhat to tell you exact directions right now, but it's just a Vaporetto ride from Venice, I'd say mainland, but it's all island. Yeah. And you go there, and we're actually one of the first things... We are the first thing you see as you come to the art district. So the whole area is a shipbuilding kind of boat fixing kind of warehouse situation. A bit like Shoreditch, you know, before people start to move into there. So industry transforming into culture. So you come into a series of warehouses, and we're one of the first that you come to, and it's on a loop and you can visit. We're doing special performances on the 7th and 9th of May, where you get enhanced screening with the live components of the score being performed, but otherwise you can watch the playback and enjoy it, and that will be there for I think 5 months. Yes.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing, right? You kind of go, oh, yeah, it's 2 weeks. Everyone has to go in these 2 weeks. Everyone goes mad. The flights are £1 million and all the rest of it. Yep. And then suddenly you're like, no, it's chill. It's September's a nice time to visit, where the mist kind of rises off the canals and it's rather beautiful. That's another time to go back for your breakdown.
Well, this is a great thing about
the breakdown of the piece.
Oh, I've already had my breakdown. Don't worry.
I'm sure it's going to go very well.
I hope so. I mean, the great thing about Giudecca is the fact that it will be somewhere that you can always go to in Venice to enjoy contemporary art. And this hasn't really been a possibility. And since a city is so linked to arts, you want to have that core of kind of, you know, you can constantly engage with what's happening there, not just on the rare occasions that, you know, that the art fair is there. So,
in terms of the Giudecca, you know, these things, these like moments of urban regeneration or transformation, the character is often determined by kind of the taste of the money men, right? They look around, and if they don't have good taste, then maybe it ends up a bit less interesting than it could be. It can feel like a wasted opportunity. What was your sense when you're there? Like, what kind of things have they brought in? Apart from you, other groups, there are some amazing artists who are kind of exhibiting, like a Yoko Ono installation is such a great thing to kick off with. Did you get a kind of positive sense that this is going to be interesting beyond just the 5 months of the Biennale?
What's happening in Giudecca is a complement to the Biennale. So it's designed to be a little bit more off the grid. So it is more autonomous. The groups that are involved have easier access. And we're not a pavilion. A pavilion is a very specific thing and it involves a certain kind of engagement and budget, etc. This is designed to have a bit more fluidity so that more people that wouldn't usually, non-traditional artists like myself, can have access to this audience, to this setting. And that way, I feel it's very positive. It's not defined by big bucks, you know. There are people that are very generously supporting our project, etc. But we've retained control creatively over that. I think it's very encouraging because I love, you know, I love the established art world. It's very interesting, supported some great stuff. But it's always good to have a little bit of friction and something to sort of counterpoint it.
And you can always tell on that opening week for the Biennale like what parties people want to go to. You clearly have an amazing back catalogue of putting on amazing nights and things. What have preparations for that been like, or will you just wing it?
Well, we've had a few different versions of what we're able to do. Yeah. Fortunately, I'm not really able to do the full extent of my event's kind of fun, just because of the limitations of where we're hosting our event. But I'm throwing in some of the same sensibility. I think of it very much, you know, fine art was something we always addressed with our club nights. We feel that clubs aren't really taken seriously as cultural incubators, but they really are. Lots of people meet there to become collectives like we do and start magazines and, you know, all kinds of things related to the arts. So it's kind of an amalgam of that sensibility, which is very much about immediacy and a group shared experience with energy, because art galleries can be quite anodyne spaces. They don't really necessarily give you a full experience, you know, full sensory experience.
It's a strange thing, people whisper in art galleries for no reason. They're not a library.
Yeah.
It's a strange thing though, right? I guess your vibe is to change that up. And obviously there's a soundtrack to the video work and all the rest of it, but with the party as well, as you're right. That's always been my excuse. They're great incubators. I should use that phrase.
Yeah, just say, I'll go to incubate some culture. I'll see you later.
See you in 3 days. Sense, you know, in a gallery that everyone's there looking and being looked at, and there's this kind of, and good clubs, you know, the Berghain bands, phones on the dance, like there's no photography. People shouldn't feel self-conscious in them. And like, is that something you kind of bring in, this idea that you can go and look at some work without thinking about how you look to other people who are also looking at it? Yeah, I'm thinking of like opening,
window into
standing
Org's mind here as well, aren't we?
Very insecure man.
I think it's mostly about, I hate to use this word, but authentic engagement, as in not creating a space that's so austere and so moded that people can't just be. And what is great about the club atmosphere is it breaks down those boundaries where people feel they have to be a prescribed way. And I don't want to denigrate the art, you know, but I don't think it does, because the world is based around immersive experiences now. So to be truly forward thinking, I love technology and I love anything to do with progressing sort of mediums that we're working with. And I think it doesn't make sense that gallery spaces remain the same. I mean, we have a whole concept called the virtual clubhouse, which we shall enact after Venice, which is about melding the club and art experience so that we can use fantastic spaces like the world's biggest labyrinth and do site-specific art within it. So you get both the central experience of the club, outdoors, fun, you know, kind of all the quirky stuff that can come from that. But you also get serious art engagement. And I don't think the two things cannot be allied. I believe that we just need to find better ways of doing it. And yeah, technology being the key to making all these things really, truly immersive and fun.
I mean, there's a lot of link-ups. It's nice that you guys are doing it in Venice, which is very much that fine art world and all the rest of it, as we know. And obviously the party stuff and the fun stuff is basically the Biennale launch week. But I think in Turin, I went to Club to Club. I've been to the Club to Club festival a couple of times. And that links up with Artissima, the art fair. So there's a lot of amazing club nights put on in palaces and in amazing places where they kind of, maybe they shift the kind of Botticelli's over a bit, but essentially you're all in the same place. That's a great, I don't know, I'm going to give you a statement rather than a question there, but it seems like your vibe as well, that kind of thing.
Very much so. And I think just to make them more and more sophisticated, more seamless, more complete, and not so, you know, so it's not incongruous that fine art sits alongside entertainment and leisure, because essentially a lot of art galleries now, that's what they're doing. It's almost like adult playgrounds, you know. Some of the art exhibitions that you've seen, you know, very much based around fun. It's fun things, which doesn't mean that they're not conceptually deep, but there's something about an experiential element to them that seems to really work. So we're moving in that direction, definitely.
And just finally, does the more sort of straight artwork, as it were, does that kind of come back and influence your work with doing club nights and all the rest of it? Is it a two-way street?
Definitely. I think it's about a quality bar. I think it's about producing things on an absolutely stunning level. And in fine art, that's the real impetus for a lot of people to create something totally unknown and beautiful. And I think that has something I've related to the club situation, you know, to take that as seriously as a piece of art, not sound like an idiot, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
To have that effect on somebody, that it touches their mind, body, spirit, everything. It's not just a little jiggle. I don't know why I'm dancing on the radio, but you know what
I mean. It's good. Fayan is wearing an amazing green coat and dancing on the radio.
Yeah.
Thank you, Fayan. And October Collective's new film, Body as Home, will be installed in the Giudecca Art District, and that opens on the 9th of May. You're with the Monocle Weekly.
I really enjoyed that.
Oh, what a lovely show. It's great stuff.
Yeah.
Amazing guests. Lovely to have Dan Richards Tones on here. I love him. I'll read anything. I'll read his letters to the Milkman.
That is it for edition 512 of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show is produced by Augustine, of course, and our studio managers were Cassie Galpin and Sarah Miles.
The Monocle Weekly will be back again, as always, next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Augustine Macellari.
And it's goodbye from me, Robert Pound. Thanks for tuning in.
Bye.